Welcome to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast, a weekly conversation about mental health, personal development, and all the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. For more information or to find a therapist in your area, visit our website at therapyforblackgirls.com. While I hope you love listening to and learning from the podcast, it is not meant to be a substitute for a relationship with a licensed mental health professional. Hey, y'all. Thanks so much for joining me for session 324 of the Therapy for Black Girls podcast. We'll get right into our conversation after a word from our sponsors. Which friend are you in your sister circle? Are you the wallflower, the peacemaker, the firecracker, or the leader? Take the quiz at sisterhoodheals.com/quiz to find out, and then make sure to grab your copy of Sisterhood Heals to find out more about how you can be a better friend and how your circle can do a better job of supporting you. Order yours today at sisterhoodheals.com. Nowadays, a lot of these big companies pretend to care about our communities and issues with nothing more than lip service. State Farm is the opposite. They're actively investing in programs and initiatives that help educate in financial literacy, give early career advice, and grow Black-owned businesses, thus leading to generational wealth, which helps protect the future of our communities. Seeing our communities grow and thrive is something they care deeply about. They want to build a future that we all can be proud of. State Farm understands that representation alone doesn't mean authenticity, that it takes a good neighbor to sponsor programs like the AXO, a year-long program that recognizes and rewards high school students for their academic and cultural achievements, and to fund programs like Project Ready, a national Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and Brown youth that to date participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and can have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Looking for hair removal tools that not only deliver smooth results, but also empower you with a sense of complete control? Enter Conair Girl Bomb, your secret weapons for smooth, sleek results made just for women. From the ultimate Girl Bomb grip and professional-grade blades, you don't have to compromise and settle for less. Conair Girl Bomb equips you with the precision and power previously reserved for men's grooming tools. So take your hair removal routine to the next level with Conair Girl Bomb. Available at ConairGirlBomb.com or a retailer near you.
Deciding to enlist in the military is a huge decision. And when you have a family, that choice may come with changing dynamics, tough conversations with children, and anxiety for spouses that are left behind. However, this isn't a battle you have to fight alone. To shed some light on this experience and share what resources are available to military families, I'm joined today by United States Navy veterans Casey King and Dr. DeAndrea Jackson, a licensed marriage and family therapist and a licensed clinical psychologist, respectively. In our conversation, we discuss strategies for explaining military deployment to young children, ways for military spouses to practice self-care, and how to help spouses reintegrate into the home after time away. If something resonates with you while enjoying our conversation, please share with us on social media using the hashtag TBGInSession. Or join us over in the Sister Circle to talk more about the episode. You can join us at community.therapyforblackgirls.com. Here's our conversation. Dr. Jackson, Casey, I'm so glad you both could join me today to discuss your dual experiences as both military veterans and military family members. To start, Dr. Jackson, could you tell me a little bit about your upbringing as a part of a military family?
My dad was a pastor up until the age of about 11. When I was about 11 years old, he decided that he was going to fulfill his dream to become a Navy chaplain. And that was a major transition for us. Prior to my birth and my brother's birth, he was active duty, but he was enlisted. And it was always his dream to become a Navy chaplain. So he decided at that point, you know, my family's all right. I'm good. I'm ready for something different. And I want to see the world. And so he and my mother decided that they were going to embark on this military journey. So into the Navy he went, and he was commissioned, and we had an amazing commissioning ceremony for him at our church. And it was such a huge celebration, just seeing him sworn in and being able to put his shoulder boards on for his rank insignia. It was such a positive experience. And then he said, we're in the Navy now, and we're moving to Okinawa, Japan. And I don't think at 11, geography really made that much sense to me, because I, you know, spin the little globe or look at the map. And I was like, okay, well, Japan is over here, but didn't know that Okinawa was this tiny little island way below the mainland of Japan. And it didn't dawn on me exactly how far we were going until we boarded a plane for a 24 plus hour flight to Okinawa, Japan, where we lived for 3 years. And that was our initial induction into what military life was like. My dad served 20 plus years on active duty. And at one point we served together. He swore me in the chaplain of the Senate's office. And it was a wonderful experience. And that's really what gave me exposure to military culture, pride in service, and a keen understanding of what military families really deal with.
A keen understanding indeed. That's quite the culture shift for an 11-year-old to go through. Thank you for sharing that, Dr. Jackson. And Casey, you're a licensed marriage and family therapist, a veteran, and a military wife. Can you talk to us about how those three experiences have impacted the work you're doing in your community?
Wow. So being a therapist, being a spouse, and also being a veteran, just all of that combined together, I think one, resilience, being able to fully understand the community that I'm working with, being able to understand trauma as a spouse, as someone who is, you know, has vicariously gone through it, I can be able to sit and hold space for those who are across from me who are going through those experiences as well.
And how many years did you and your partner serve in the military?
Collectively, almost 32 years. I did about 8.5 years. I told my husband, you can have it. I'm done with this. And he just retired last year after 23 years.
Wow. Yeah. So great deal of service from the both of you. Did you all meet in the military?
Yes. Actually, he came through. We're in Gulfport, Mississippi. And I noticed his car before I noticed him. I'm such a lover of old school cars. And I saw the Cadillac. I was a military police. He was coming through the gate. And I told my girlfriend that was there with me, I said, I really like that car. And he just happened to be in there, and he was handsome too.
Ooh, I love that. Wow, what a romantic military meet cute story. So after hearing from both of you, I can already imagine that the experience of being either a spouse of a military member or a child of one can be quite stressful. Dr. Jackson, can you talk a little bit about mental health support that you and your family received as you were getting acclimated to this new life?
Because we were new to the experience, I don't even think my parents knew too much about what resources may have been available there to support us with that kind of transition. You do have access to the behavioral health clinics, and oftentimes in overseas environments, they do have child psychologists on staff. That would have been of major assistance, but really the way we navigated it was just as a family and as a community. And as you started to get closer to other people, when you move to a new location, regardless of whether you're domestic or overseas, you're assigned a sponsor. And that sponsor gets you acclimated to the area. They tell you where things are. They show you where you're going to live. They introduce you to other people to help build community for you while you're there. So a lot of it for us was really leaning into the people that we were meeting and learning to understand what their experiences are while they're living there. I do recall before we moved to Okinawa, we met with a distant family friend who had just returned from Okinawa. And I don't know that that was really helpful, Dr. Joy.
Oh.
The kids were like, oh my goodness, we're so glad to be back in America. We didn't have cable. They just got cable. One of the things that like astonished me, they were like, we didn't have real milk on the bases until recently. And I said, what? y'all don't have 2% milk. What's going on? But because the distance, the location, some of those creature comforts that we experience here domestically are not always accessible there. One of the highlights of our tour while we were there was that they got a Taco Bell on base just before we were leaving. We got to get a taste of Mexican pizzas again. So those can be some of the hard transitions of figuring out how you move, right? How do you physically relocate your family? And then how do you connect with new people once you get there? It was really challenging. To support us, I think my parents did keep us in school. We moved towards the end of the school year. And of course, you know how that is. Moving children can be difficult. But because my dad's orders were executed in April, we did some acceleration at our private school prior to leaving the DC area. So we had technically finished all of the academic requirements for the school year. But my parents had enough foresight to say, if we don't get them in school, they're not going to be able to meet friends or establish their own community of peers. Once we get there, it'll be harder. So while we knew we were finished with school and we were going through the motions, we understood that it was an important piece of our transition. And that was really helpful. One of the first people that I met when I moved there, her name was Tori, one of my best friends in the whole wide world, we say. She was one of the first people I met, and she really helped me acclimate to what it was like being overseas. We lived on the same base and we were able to link up. And that was an interesting experience. And I appreciate the depth that our friendship still has because of that unique experience that we shared during our time in Okinawa.
So Dr. Jackson, you of course have the unique vantage point of having been a psychologist in the Navy and also having your dad's experience. Can you talk a little bit about how you've seen mental health conversations change in the military across some of that time?
With the ramp up, I think, of the war, Iraqi freedom, enduring freedom, there was a lot of focus on trauma. There was a lot of focus on deployment. There was a lot of focus on military readiness. Like, how do we keep our force actively worldwide deployable? And so there has been a focus on making sure that active duty service members are robustly supported with the resources that are provided. And military psychology has really always been on the forefront of new trends or emerging trends in the field of psychology. So from the standpoint of active duty service members, I think it's in a really great space. Is there always work to be done? Sure. But it's pretty solid in terms of what they're able to provide. Family-wise, I think there are more opportunities. But the major military treatment facilities, the clinics that are typically operated on base, which is what we would identify as the military treatment system, is not often geared towards supporting the dependents of the active duty service members in the mental health clinic specifically. You can go there and get your care for primary care or a specialist that you need to see. But if the behavioral health clinic is at capacity, they start deferring to the network, family members, spouses, children even, for their care. And I think that's an area where things could improve. It's really challenging as a military family member to move into a community space or with a community provider who really understands the culture, the stresses, and the challenges that military families experience on a day-to-day basis. And that's because I think there's been so much talk about trauma and about deployment that it kind of gets circumscribed as that's the biggest stressor for a military family, when it is one of the bigger stressors, but it's not in the top four, actually, in terms of military families who were surveyed around what their stressors actually are.
Can you say more about that survey? What were some of the bigger stressors?
So this survey, the most recent one, included about 9,300 military families worldwide, and it's called the Military Family Lifestyle Survey. And this 2023 iteration of it found that the top four stressors were family financial well-being, military spouse employment, the impact of service, so things like time away, relocation, child education, child care. Those were the top three for active service families. And then for veterans, the major issue was access to quality health care. Deployment, not anywhere to be found in those top levels of what those stressors are. And I think in part that's because the pace of deployments has really slowed down significantly in the last several years. But I think it also just recognizes that we pretty much expect at some point our loved one is going to deploy. whether that's on a ship, on a brief training mission, for an extended period of time. We expect that's part of military service, but it's the day-to-day stressors that can tend to feel even more overwhelming. And I think that sometimes gets overlooked.
So you've mentioned when the behavioral clinics on base are at capacity, they begin referring to the network. Are you talking about like neighboring therapists in the area who probably do a lot of work with military families just because of where they're located? Is that what you mean?
I'm referring to the insurance network. So neighboring therapists in the area who are credentialed providers through Military One Source, which is affiliated with, I think it's Beacon Health in Caerleon, or those who accept TRICARE. That's who they will then defer or push referrals out to so that dependent family members can receive services.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because when I think about some of the resources that have come out of the military, like some of the Gold Star standards for lots of evidence-based treatments, they come from the military. So it's interesting that they haven't expanded and, you know, started to think about like, okay, how do we take care of the greater family outside of the person serving?
You know, the military budget is always up for discussion.
Of course.
Political settings. So I think that's one element of it, because to expand, you have to be able to bring in additional providers and often ones who are not in uniform. Our pipelines, I think I discussed that in Becoming a Therapist, the episode, the second one. Those pipelines can sometimes be a little slower. And there's not a whole lot of people raising their hands saying, I want to serve in the United States military. Those of us who choose to serve are 1% of the general population in the United States. And then that percentage gets even smaller. Maybe it's 3% who serve and 1% officer. Can't remember the data. But it is a very small subset of the population who chooses to put on the uniform and wear the cloth of our nation. And so that becomes an even bigger issue, right? When you're talking about clinic management and personnel management, we just don't have the bandwidth of active duty service members to be able to treat all of our active duty personnel in addition to their families and any veterans. And so that then requires them to make decisions around how many folk can we bring on? What's our budget? What's our manning? What's our space? It just becomes that much more of a challenging experience. So where we can refer people to trusted resources that we believe have received the cultural competency training to be able to understand the needs of military families or military service members, that can be really helpful so that those on active duty can focus on maintaining the mission of keeping our democracy alive and well and keeping us safe and free.
More from our conversation after the break. Nowadays, a lot of these big companies pretend to care about our communities and issues with nothing more than lip service. State Farm is the opposite. They're actively investing in programs and initiatives that help educate in financial literacy, give early career advice, and grow Black-owned businesses, thus leading to generational wealth, which helps protect the future of our communities. Seeing our communities grow and thrive is something they care deeply about. They want to build a future that we all can be proud of. State Farm understands that representation alone doesn't mean authenticity, that it takes a good neighbor to sponsor programs like the AXO, a year-long program that recognizes and rewards high school students for their academic and cultural achievements, and to fund programs like Project Ready, a National Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and brown youth that to date participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and can have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. So as often happens, I think with mental health professionals, some area of our life often becomes our area of study. So your dissertation was actually on the impact of deployment on children of active duty personnel. Can you talk a little bit about what that study found?
Oh, man. Can I tell you a little bit about why I decided to do that first?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I went to boarding school for high school. And in my senior year, it's a big time. You get a sweater. You have a senior presentation. It's a very special experience. But that year, my father deployed. He was assigned to a ship. And for the majority of my senior year, he was off someplace where I didn't know, right? And it was very difficult to be able to share moments with him. was at a time where my parents gave me and my roommate a camcorder so that we could record some of the little moments that happened in the year. And I could mail those to my dad and he would receive them in maybe 2-3 weeks after the recording actually took place. And in the instances where he was able to call, it was like, I'm breaking the rules. I'm going to keep my cell phone because I know my dad is in port. And you're just going to have to excuse me as I walk out of this class to take my father's phone call kind of experience. Or moments where you couldn't even reach him. You know he's in port and maybe I missed the call, but it's not a number that I can call back. And so that was a really difficult time, especially in adolescence as their major milestones, but also major challenges. And it was at that point in time that I realized this has an impact. This is an important thing to consider. My cousin, her husband is also an active duty service member. He's a physician and he deployed at a time when she was pregnant, missed delivery. She didn't have her husband there to support her through that process. And she had one small child. And so just seeing in my family what that experience was like to deal with the absence, the ambiguous absence of your service member, although they're very much still part of your family system, I said, I need to explore this a little bit. And I actually changed my dissertation topic to reflect that. I was previously interested in the relationships of Black women. And I said, but there's not so much information out there, not too many studies focusing on the challenges of military families and the children's experience. So I did decide to explore that in my research. And we identified that throughout the cycle of deployment, there are different issues that may arise for children. In the ramp up, there are lots of feelings, maybe confusion, some anxiety. There could be some concern, maybe a little overwhelm, depending on the age of the child. As that deployment cycle ramps up and then the family member leaves and goes away for training, but they're not yet quite gone. They're just not as accessible. And then there's the deployment period where the family is adjusting, right? Like, okay, we know our roles. We know what's expected. We anticipate what the routine is when we might hear from our loved one. And we're able to be resilient, to pull it together and keep going. But then we found that there's a lot of challenge on the reintegration period. You get all excited because you get notification. I'm coming home on this day, right? And I remember my dad coming home and he came in the port and you see all the nice white uniforms standing on the deck of the ship. And that was super exciting, right? And there was the transition of him coming home and acclimating. He had some sea legs, so he wasn't driving for a little while because things are just different after you get off of the water. And then it became a process of how do we reintegrate dad into the system? And in our research, we found that that's a really trying time for the family. The roles have been renegotiated. The loved one who's been deployed has been gone for quite some time. So maybe they're not the disciplinarian or the final sign off on what someone can and cannot do as a teenager or as a young person. And finding their way back into that space is difficult for the service member and it's difficult for the family. Sometimes during those parts of the process, we find that younger children particularly may have some regression in their milestones. So you might see night terrors, you might see bedwetting, you might see more babyish behaviors that you thought your child had grown out of coming back up again because they got really big feelings and they're not quite sure how to handle all of that. And with that research, we were able to identify what services were out there at that point in time. But there were some services emerging at that point in time to help deal with those specific challenges. And they're robust even now, even though the pace of deployment's not being what they used to be. Those resources are still very much there and accessible and available to military families. We also saw that upon reintegration, there's a lot of marital stress, right? There's the renegotiation of who's doing what around the home and who's doing what with the children and the financial element. A lot of people don't know that when you deploy, you actually get an increase in pay. So coming home from deployment can actually pose for some families financial strain or financial stress if the money's not been managed well during the deployment period. So that can be an issue. There's a whole issue with navigating the relationship after that honeymoon period. My boo is back. My bae is here, right? There can be that difficulty of all this time you've been gone and I'm tired. It's your turn to pick up, right? It's your turn to do a little bit more. But that service member themselves is coming back and they're saying, all this time I've been gone, it's not been a vacation and I'm tired. And if communication is not good, if parenting practices are not on the same page, it can cause a lot of conflict. And as children, observing the dynamic between the parents, of course, that has an impact on them as well.
Mm-hmm. So based on the results of your study, Dr. Jackson, it sounds like the children of military members are particularly affected by this lifestyle of constant moves and what sounds like a lot of regular uncertainty. Casey, you're the mother of three school-age children. I'd love to hear from you. What kinds of things do you do with your children to try and make the situation a little easier for them and help to ground them in this experience?
I am very big on family. I grew up with two of my cousins living with my first cousins. We're so close, their kids call me auntie. So we always try to make sure, always call it the world tour when we transfer. We always try to make sure we stop by and see family. I try to make sure they are very connected to their family. They know who their family is, even though they're not close by, and try to have some form of the relationship that we had. So that's one thing I try to do, is make sure they're still connected to family. Another thing is I talk to them, let them know we're moving. My husband, one time, he did a whole PowerPoint presentation to talk about where we're going. What's that going to be like? Does that military strategic thing? We try to make it a family event, and also just ask them how they're feeling. The middle one, he's such an extrovert. He's always excited for the adventure. The oldest is like, we got to do this again. I have to meet people again. And so we always try to make sure to check in with them and see how they're feeling, where their anxiety is. The oldest one, she gets a little anxious sometimes. So just talking to them about that and letting them know regardless that we're going to be there. As a family unit, we're all going to be there. And that's the most important thing. But our doors are always open if they want to talk about the transition, if they want to talk about the feelings that they're going through. And we let them know those feelings are completely normal and we'll be here with them throughout those.
That communication sounds key. Going back to you, Dr. Jackson, are there any specific resources that you can share for anybody who's enjoying our conversation, who might find themselves in this situation and want to know where they can find support, specifically any resources for children?
For children, the ones that I really like are Operation Purple. Operation Purple has camps for children and for military families geared towards connecting each other and creating that community of understanding and familiarity. And so they offer these camps throughout the year. And I think they have a summer camp and a one-day family camp that's offered. And you can find them online under Operation Purple. For relocation services, there are resources through the Yellow Ribbon for National Guard families. And there are resources through the Penn State School resources about military families. And that addresses the specific needs of military children and how they can thrive academically, behaviorally, and with their mental health by connecting them with individuals who understand the needs of military families. For children and families, there's also a program called FOCUS, and that stands for Families Overcoming Under Stress. And they have resources to assist military families with common issues that they experience, even outside of the context of deployment.
Thank you for that. And Casey, do you know of any resources that are specific to Black military families?
Yes, it's Facebook. Facebook, there's a group, Black Military Wives, Black Military Spouses. They are there because those are things, again, that we need when we're looking for a Black therapist. We're looking for a Black OBGYN. We want to know the schools that have Black teachers or military teachers. So for us to still be intertwined with our community as Black people is definitely important to us, because 92% of military spouses are women, but only 15% of them are Black women. And so let's say, for example, on one street of 10 homes on one side, you may have one or two that are Black women. I lived in a neighborhood on both sides of the street. It was me and it was one other person two doors down, and that was it. And we think 15% is a really big number. But when you look not just stateside, you look in other countries, there are not many of us collectively around. So we do rely on those groups, the Black military wives, Black military spouses, Black spouses of whatever state that you're in, to really help and be a support during these times.
Thank you both so much for sharing those resources. I'm sure many people will find those helpful. I want to go back to a comment you made earlier, Dr. Jackson, about being the partner of an active duty personnel member and how dynamics can change once that military member comes back home. Can you talk a little about what treatment would look like and how you might help that kind of couple with some of those difficult conversations?
Oh, man. Couples counseling. Can't stress it enough. If you need it, see if your local military treatment facility offers couples counseling. And if they don't, get a referral to the network with someone that you can trust who understands the culture. That would be my first line of intervention, if it's necessary. Like if there are those level of problems and acute conflict, couples therapy would be the thing. In the absence of that, there are other options provided through chaplains, active duty chaplains. All of their departments tend to offer retreats. They also offer counseling and support, pastoral counseling and support that can be accessible to military families. But in the office, I would recommend talking a lot about communication and roles and expectations, talking about needs, emotional needs, attachment needs, like what is going on that may be missed that your partner can come in and address so that the core issues are being met, right? Oftentimes it's not just, I'm tired physically, it's, I'm tired. Do you see all that I've been doing? Do you value the sacrifice that I've been making while you've been able to go and do your job? Do you understand that there were a lot of things that may have happened here that we didn't discuss or share with you because you needed to be focused on the mission? That's really often encouraged, is that you, military spouses, you keep that to yourself and you figure that out with your support system so that you are not distracting the service member from what they need to take care of, sometimes in very hostile environments. And so a lot of times I think there's a need to get to the root of the issue and not just spend a lot of time addressing the surface level situational factors that may be coming up.
Mm. And Dr. Jackson, you also mentioned even in your personal family around getting ready for deployment and what a big deal that was. What kinds of suggestions or advice would you give to a family who's maybe preparing for deployment?
Sure. I would recommend spending lots of time together and finding out what your strategy for communication will be. A lot of times you won't be able to nail down specific days and times that you'll call, but identify what's really important to you, what your service member needs while they're away, and what you need to hear from them or have from them while they're gone and when they return. So spending lots of time together, creating those milestones. If you have young children, Build-A-Bear is a wonderful thing where you can go and record a story or a little message so they can continue to hear your voice while you're gone. But being mindful of the fact that there's sacrifice on both ends, and each partner validating what it's going to take for you all to get through this as a team, right? And understanding how you can best support each other during the period of physical separation, I think would be really important.
And can you talk a little bit more about like how you'd explain that to young children in particular? You know, like this idea that maybe mom or dad is going to be gone, and even feelings of like maybe losing a family member to the military that I think could come up for either children or even adults. What kinds of things would you say about that?
In preparing children, Sesame Street used to have some really great resources, and I still think those are active resources to help talk to young children about what deployment is and what separation looks like, giving them expectation that they're going away for work, and this is an exciting thing, and they're doing their job, and we look forward to hearing from them. Keeping it very age appropriate is going to be important. They don't need to know all the risk that's involved. They're not going to understand all the risk that is involved. But you can explain it to them in age-appropriate ways and use materials from the library or Sesame Street resources to help explain it to really young children. With older children, I think you have frank discussions. Like, look, this is where we are. This is going to be taxing for us, and it's quite a shift in our family dynamic. So this is how, as a family, we're going to navigate this process. And we want your active involvement. We want to understand how you feel about what's going on and what you think about what's going on. And we're going to hold space for the fact that it's going to be frustrating sometimes, that we're all going to have some moments where this isn't the lifestyle we necessarily want or the experience we want to be living through. But how can we continue to focus together as a family to get through the moment? Dealing with loss, I don't think there's any easy way to explain that. I think it's helpful, if there has been loss, to utilize the resources within the military community. Always, if there's a death notification that needs to be made, a CAECO officer, I can't remember what that acronym exactly stands for, but a CAECO officer is going to show up at the door. That's where you see the person come in a full uniform and knocks on the door, and the service member's spouse knows exactly what's going on. That's a CAECO call, and those are really difficult to make, but those CAECO officers are the points of contact with the resources that you need to connect you to the entire process and provide support throughout that process if a death notification has been made. That can include what benefits are, how those benefits are distributed, how a service is coordinated, and what resources, mental health-wise, are even available for you.
More from our conversation after the break. Nowadays, a lot of these big companies pretend to care about our communities and issues with nothing more than lip service. State Farm is the opposite. They're actively investing in programs and initiatives that help educate in financial literacy, give early career advice, and grow Black-owned businesses, thus leading to generational wealth, which helps protect the future of our communities. Seeing our communities grow and thrive is something they care deeply about. They want to build a future that we all can be proud of. State Farm understands that representation alone doesn't mean authenticity, that it takes a good neighbor to sponsor programs like the AXO, a year-long program that recognizes and rewards high school students for their academic and cultural achievements, and to fund programs like Project Ready, a National Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and brown youth that to date participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and can have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Dr. Jackson, you just brought up a very important and I'd imagine common anxiety for military families, which is the death of a military service member. Casey, as a military spouse, have you ever been in a situation where you were unsure about your partner's safety?
I can't remember if it was Afghanistan or Kuwait, and a base was bombed. This was back when there was only Skype to communicate. There were no phone calls, there were no FaceTime. And at that time, you could watch the news because they shut everything down. If a base is bombed, everything is shut down. So there were so many times those incidents happening where I'm just waiting on someone to come knock at my door, because there was no phone call or text to say, hey, I'm okay, everything is good. You're watching the news to figure out whatever information they can release, and you're waiting on someone to call you or someone to knock on your door. And the knock on the door mean your husband or your spouse is no longer here. So there were so many of those moments that surprised me, because you don't know how to prepare for it. There's no way to actually prepare for that moment. So I had a few of those moments that really, my anxiety was so high.
Thank you for sharing that, Casey. I'm sure many of our military family listeners are listening and sharing that emotion with you. I want to go back to the reintegration process you mentioned, Dr. Jackson. For those family members who are fortunate enough to have their military member come back from a deployment, what kinds of suggestions would you offer to family for what life looks like while the person is deployed? And then what is the process of even reintegrating them? What does that look like?
Well, while they're gone, establish your routine. Do what is going to work for you. You are at home managing and holding it down. So whatever process is going to be useful to you, engage in that.
Okay, so I'm hearing that establishing a routine is key. We talk about the importance of routines and prioritizing care of yourself here on the podcast all the time. So I can only imagine the benefit it offers to military families. Casey, from your experience, what sorts of routine self-care practices have been helpful for you to engage in while your partner was away?
A lot of naps, I love to sleep. A lot of naps, a lot of walks. I work out a lot. And that's something I still do every morning, is taking time for myself. I'm a big believer in taking time for myself before I take care of everybody else. So I'm usually up at least an hour or two before the kids, checking in with myself, reading. If I have a moment where I need to cry, I've had plenty of those moments, you know, have those moments and make sure I take care of myself through moving my body or sometimes just being silent and writing, having a cup of coffee and sitting outside and watching the sun come up, or just having some moments like that to really just take care of my spirit and my energy. Those are usually things that I find that works best for me.
And Casey, could you also talk a little bit about your own experience managing your home while your husband was deployed and then helping to reintegrate him back into the home after deployment?
I can't say it's an easy thing to manage when your spouse is gone for 6 months, 8 months, 10 months. We just really do the best that we can. There's been times where I don't work because I want to fully be there, because they know they have two parents. One is inactive. So I have to do double the work. So that may mean for me not having a job outside of the home for a period of time so I can be fully available for them throughout the day. When he comes back, we are already in such a routine without him that coming back for him, it's okay, so where do I fit in this family? That's a real thing. I know this is my wife. I know these are my children, but where do I fit in? It's almost like, am I in your way? What do you need me to do? So for him, it's been many times of observing or asking questions. What does this kid like to do now? Has their favorite food changed? Has their favorite color changed? Who's their teacher? Which classroom is theirs? What's their temperament now? And even for the kids, being okay with going to ask daddy a question, because I've been talking to mommy so much for 6 months, asking her for everything. So it can be that bypass daddy, come to mommy. And that parent or that soldier may see it as a disrespectful thing, but we're so used to you not being here. So being gone for 6 months, after about 2-3 months, we're in the new groove. And then when the soldier comes back, it takes maybe another 2 to 3 months to reshuffle this thing all over again, to reintegrate him. It's very tasking, I must say.
Dr. Jackson, are there any other strategies you'd recommend for helping a spouse reintegrate after time spent away from home?
Once you get that notification that your loved one is coming home and you start preparing, it's not all just about the party. Right? Understand what they need. How do we celebrate your return? And how do we give you space to process and reacclimate? Oftentimes on the heels of a deployment, service member has some leave time, may want to take a vacation. They may just want to be at home. They may be coming back with very little insight about how their experiences have really impacted them. And there may be a delayed onset of what those experiences may be, whether that's trauma or depression or anxiety. Making space for them to be able to feel and reconnect is going to be really important. Try not to overstimulate or overschedule. Get a lot of buy-in from that service member about what it is that they want to be able to do when they do return home. Explain to them, this is what we've been doing since you've been gone. Our 17-year-old is doing this and our 5-year-old is doing that. And these are some of the milestones that have occurred while you've been away. And I'm wanting to loop you into how we've been doing things. And once you get back and you've decompressed a little bit, let's have a family discussion about how we renegotiate the roles and how we discuss the current expectations so that we're moving into a space where there's frequent communication. I've heard a lot of complaints from military spouses and even military children that they're like, my service member parent treats me like I'm one of their sailors, soldiers, or airmen, and I'm not, right? It's kind of easy to fall into that with the default way that we communicate. In military, if you're in a position of leadership, you say something and it gets done. You don't have to repeat yourself often. that doesn't happen in homes. You have to get comfortable with repeating yourself. And so communication is so key, and involving each other in an understanding of what's needed, what the routine has been, and how we're preparing for a shift, I think is a recipe for success.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Jackson, you mentioned that some service members might come back with some trauma they've experienced, or even have an onset of depression or anxiety. What kinds of things should a partner or a spouse know about how to support a service member who's coming back home and maybe experiencing some of these changes?
Keep an eye out for what has changed, what looks different. Remind the service member of what their available options are, but be compassionate with the fact that there's a lot of stigma in the military around mental health still, because the worldwide deployable component and fitness for duty is still a huge piece of every service member's career. And some people believe that as soon as I walk into behavioral health or as soon as I sit down with the psych, that disposition is going to be changed and that's going to have a negative impact on my career. And to be quite frank, sometimes for some people it might, depending on what it is that you do, unfortunately. And there may be some resistance to that because they're thinking about the time invested, the identity that they've developed by putting that uniform on every single day. So be compassionate, but notice what the changes are, right? Offer them support and remind them of what the resources are. And sometimes it's helpful to even say, but you know what, love, at some point you're going to retire from this military system. And at some point they're going to want to know everything that's been going on with you in terms of your health and your well-being. And this is an important thing for them to know because your country has made a commitment to you to take care of you because of the service that you've offered. So let them take care of you, whether it's in the now or in the future. And the only way we're going to be able to do that is to talk to somebody about what's going on. A really helpful resource, again, can be the chaplains. They have confidentiality that is similar to behavioral health confidentiality, sometimes even a little bit better. And so from that standpoint, they can be a first line of support where a diagnosis may not need to be established, but support needs to be offered. Chaplains can be a really great resource for that. Fleet and Family Services for the Navy and Marine Corps can also be a great resource. If there's no diagnosis to be had, you can be seen at Fleet and Family, or the same thing within the Army is called Military Family Life Counseling is MFLAC for the Army. And for the Air Force, their support is Military Family Readiness System. And sometimes that can be a place where service members can get support without a diagnosis before approaching behavioral health. So it kind of reduces a little bit of that concern or fear about walking into the behavioral health system. And that can be a way to disarm your service member, but say, hey, we need some support here. Those can be alternative options of support. But being mindful of what depression looks like, what anxiety looks like, not assuming that everybody who's been exposed to trauma is going to develop PTSD, but understanding what some of those signs are is really helpful as well. And then one thing that I think doesn't get enough attention is looking at the relationship that your service member might have with substances. Rarely are we going to see service members using illicit substances because of the consequences of that. But alcohol can be part of what military culture looks like. And it's harder sometimes to identify when we've moved from a space of this is what military culture looks like into excess and problematic relationship with alcohol. So being mindful of mood changes, sleeping changes, changes in the way that they're interacting with their loved ones, with their colleagues, with their supervisors, substance use, all of those things are things to be mindful of, I think.
Dr. Jackson, you've talked a little bit about military deployment readiness. Can you explain what that means to our listeners who might be unaware?
So it's fitness for duty, and that relates to one's ability to, at the drop of a dime, be worldwide deployable. And it is a military psychologist, social worker, whatever level of behavioral health treatment you're at in for active duty personnel, it's imperative that you're considering that disposition at all times, because we have to maintain a fighting force that's ready to go when we need them to, right? If the balloon goes up, how many people can this particular unit send off on that given day that they're assigned to? And so we have to be mindful of what diagnoses can't be treated in a deployed setting, things like bipolar disorder. Of course, serious mental illness is not something that could be treated in a worldwide deployable kind of status. Sometimes anxiety, any sort of medication use, those kinds of things might impact someone's ability to be able to deploy. And because every service member is a soldier, sailor, or airman first, we have to always maintain that fitness for duty and readiness to go.
So if you're not able to maintain that status, then your status becomes what?
There are options there. So if you're not able to go when the balloon goes up, there are options. They're called different things for different branches of service, but essentially it is limited duty. So for a little while, we're going to say maybe 6 months, you're not able to do your job and we need to focus on treatment. So we might offer you what we would see in the civilian world to be reasonable accommodations. Change in work schedule, change in shift, ability to leave early in order to attend behavioral health appointments, maybe some time off work altogether to pursue a higher level of care like intensive outpatient therapy or partial hospitalization. Those put some restrictions on the ability for a military component or a unit to be able to move that person or send them off very quickly. So it affects the needs of the Navy. And it's important for active duty clinicians, they all know that it's important for them to be able to understand and make those dispositions appropriately so that the units are able to do what they need to do or get more people without there being a specific personnel challenge or a manning challenge.
So as a military psychologist, a part of what you're doing as a part of your care is assessing for this fitness for duty.
Absolutely. Now, I want to be clear, I'm no longer a military psychologist.
Yes, of course.
They'd be like, who is this? And why does she not get clearance from the public affairs officer? I am a former military psychologist. And yes, absolutely. It's at the forefront of most clinicians' minds. That's something they need to be mindful of.
Got it. Both of you have already given us a ton of resources, but are there any others that you think somebody who's enjoying our conversation might benefit from?
Military OneSource is a really great resource. It's one that's widely known often amongst military communities because they have a wide range of benefits to address the specific needs, whether it's financial stressors, couples counseling, individual counseling that's needed. We talked about the component specific or service specific family resources. Military OneSource is a broad umbrella that will take any service member from any branch, veterans or their family members, to provide them with access to some of these resources. And as far as I'm aware, with Military Resource, you're able to have some complimentary sessions for individual therapy. You do have to go through a process of applying for those benefits and finding an in-network counselor and things like that. But those sessions don't get charged to you for a certain number. And you'd have to speak with a Military OneSource representative to identify exactly how many of those sessions you would receive without out-of-pocket costs to you. But that's a really great resource as well.
Perfect. We'll be sure to include that and all of the other resources that you mentioned in our show notes. We could keep this conversation going on, I'm sure, much longer. But to close us out, could you both let our community know where we can find you?
My website is thecaseyking.com. And I am on Instagram, TikTok, KCS King, across the board, Facebook, all across the board, KCS King.
Our website is epiphanypsychotherapy.com. And I can be found on Instagram at Dr.D. Jackson.
And Casey, I know you've recently released your book, The Life of a Military Spouse, Your Dreams Matter Too. How would you like for folks to engage with this body of work?
I would really like you to go out and purchase and just support the book, because I believe this book would be a great help to so many military spouses who've thought about giving up, who are at the point in their life they said, you know what, I'll just do nothing. My dreams don't matter. I don't know a spouse that has been told, and maybe there are many that have been told, hey, make sure you take care of yourself. Whatever your goals are, you can achieve those goals as well. You're more than just a military spouse. You're more than just your children's mom or dad. you have goals, you have dreams, and those do matter too. And they don't always have to be on the back burner. There's a way that you can achieve those things you desire.
Well said. Well, thank you both so much for joining me today. We've been wanting to have this conversation for a while, so I'm so glad that we were able to talk with both of you. I'm so glad Dr. Jackson and Casey were able to share their expertise and experience with us today. To learn more about them and their work, visit the show notes at therapyforblackgirls.com/session324. And don't forget to text two of your girls right now and encourage them to check out the episode. If you're looking for a therapist in your area, check out our therapist directory at therapyforblackgirls.com/directory. And if you want to continue digging into this topic or just be in community with other sisters, come on over and join us in the Sister Circle. It's our cozy corner of the internet designed just for Black women. You can join us at community.therapyforblackgirls.com. This episode was produced by Frida Lucas, Elise Ellis, and Zaria Taylor. Editing was done by Denison Bradford. Thank y'all so much for joining me again this week. I look forward to continuing this conversation with you all real soon. Take good care. Which friend are you in your sister circle? Are you the wallflower, the peacemaker, the firecracker, or the leader? Take the quiz at sisterhoodheals.com/quiz to find out, and then make sure to grab your copy of Sisterhood Heals to find out more about how you can be a better friend and how your circle can do a better job of supporting you. Order yours today at sisterhoodheals.com.
Looking for hair removal tools that not only deliver smooth results, but also empower you with a sense of complete control? Enter Conair Girl Bomb, your secret weapons for smooth, sleek results, made just for women. From the ultimate Girl Bomb grip and professional-grade blades, you don't have to compromise and settle for less. Conair Girl Bomb equips you with the precision and power previously reserved for men's grooming tools. So take your hair removal routine to the next level with Conair Girl Bomb. Available at conairgirlbomb.com or a retailer near you.